the language of imagination.
Since last month, Studio 360 has been gathering poems, hundreds of poems, new poems about the summer written by high school students for our latest listener challenge. Today, I'll check in with a professor who's got to read and judge every one of them.
You know, a lot of them were like, summer actually sucks.
That's youth wasted on the young. Maybe writing about things that suck make them a little better. Although Rufus Wainwright says we shouldn't expect too much there.
You know, I did realize that artistry and poetry will not save your life. And there's a point when you have to get off the trolley ride and go see a therapist.
I'll talk with Rufus Wainwright, and he'll perform live here in our studio. That and much more is ahead today in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Right after this.
Woke up this morning.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And by TiVo, unifying cable, on-demand, and streaming apps like Netflix without the need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or user experience. Learn more at TiVo.com.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Abigail Washburn was on her way to fulfilling her dream of becoming a high-flying international lawyer in Beijing. Then she heard a song that made her rethink those plans in a big way.
Shady Grove, my little love, Shady Grove, I say, Shady Grove, my little love.
That's later this hour, but to start the show, there's a vast new nationwide scheme going on to display art. Well, actually, images of art that's just gotten underway. It's called Art Everywhere, and it's rolling out all over the country this month using 50,000 outdoor advertising venues, billboards, bus shelters, video screens at gyms to show famous American pictures, such as Hopper's Nighthawks, Warhol's Campbell Soup Can, Grant Wood's American Gothic, and many more. The organizers say they hope the billboards will bring more people to museums to see the real things. Great, right? More people looking at art. Who could argue with that? Well, actually, if you've been to a museum recently, you might argue with that. Peter Sheldahl, the art critic for The New Yorker magazine, wrote this week that museums are so crowded that when you go there, all you experience is crowdedness. And he's not too crazy about Art Everywhere either. Peter Sheldahl is here with me now. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
So there are 58 works of art being featured in Art Everywhere. Talk about the process by which those were chosen.
Well, they were nominated. I think 100 were nominated by the participating museums, and there was an online vote of, you know, some fabulous number of voters. The curators, museums, added 8 to, I guess, gently correct the taste of the multitude. And the first place choice, which I found wonderful and ironic, is Edward Hopper's Nighthawks.
Because it is so much about a kind of murky melancholy, which...
An intense melancholy, you know, middle of the night. You know, we are a passerby looking into this glamorously bleak wee hours diner. It hits on a very basic and familiar feeling of being an American. Estranged from other people, and there it is on Times Square, flashing.
yeah,
and you know, I mean, in a way, that's kind of cool. I don't mm-hmm. mind that. I don't think you're not hurting the painting,
right? But it seems as though you feel it's symptomatic of a larger problem of everything.
Well, I think that you know, artists taking on this strange glamour, and the love of it has become quantified by dollars in the market and fannies through the door of museums. I mean, I've been a critic in New York for close to half a century, and I'm not used to this degree of company, but it's up to me to adjust. By the way, I don't think all museums are crowded. In fact, many aren't.
Art Everywhere is also, as part of its thing, holding an Instagram contest where people post selfies in front of these displays.
Oh, sure.
Does that gross you out also?
It makes me swallow hard. You know, I also referred to this photo that was in the Times of crowds looking at the Mona Lisa in the Louvre, which it looked like a rave, you know, masses of people holding camera phones in the air and doing selfies. And, you know, that's the world we live in.
A lot of people hearing this conversation are undoubtedly going to consider it that totally un-American thing, elitist. Is it that?
Well, I think that's true. I mean, but I think in American democracy, anybody gets to be an elitist. We don't get to lord it over anybody, but we get to credit ourselves with caring a little more, knowing a little more.
And just so listeners know that you're not in any total sense an elitist, you are also famous for putting on a magnificent country fireworks show every year. Did you start doing the fireworks show as any way an art project? What made you
never? No, it's only recently that I have permitted myself to think of it as art at all. I didn't want to get precious. No, it started out with a six-pack of beer and some bottle rockets, you know, 25 years ago.
So you have all these people helping you do these fireworks, and you're managing them. Maybe you get a feeling in this summer of Jeff Koons, who has this big retrospective in New York. You get a feeling of what it's like to be him.
A little, sure. I mean, and I think anyone who's willing to go with Jeff Koons can get a little bit of that. It's really bizarre. I mean, he's really crazy, but he is undoubtedly creative. And, you know, part of what, you know, really good art, even great art, tells us is what our age is like. I mean, Andy Warhol, for heaven's sakes. And a lot of what Jeff Koons is feeding back to us is, for many people, including me, repellent. But damn it, it's the truth.
And I guess in that sense, art everywhere is somewhere in the a similar ballpark.
Well, except it's slippery and sentimental. And pious, you know, it's like art is good for you. No, it's not. Using art to promote art, I mean, to me, art everywhere is pure symptom. There's no raising of consciousness in it, as there is in Jeff Koons.
Peter Sheldahl, it has been a pleasure. Thank you very much for talking with me.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So what do you think? The more the merrier as far as art's concerned, even pictures on billboards? Talk to us at studio360.org or on Twitter, where we're at Studio360Show. This summer, for our latest listener challenge, we've been asking high school students to submit poetry around the theme of summer. We're calling it the Battle of the High School Bards, and it's co-presented by the Scholastic Art and Writing Awards. We've had a tremendous response so far. Hundreds of you have sent in your poems inspired by road trips, cool water on hot nights, aimless wandering, all of that summer stuff. We'll announce the winner in a few weeks. But in the meantime, I wanted to check in with our judge for the Summer Poetry Challenge, who has been reading all of the poems. She's Columbia University professor and poet, Dorothea Lasky. Dottie, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, as I said, we had hundreds of entries so far, and I'm sure if I know anything about young people, during the week as the deadline approaches, we'll get many more. From the ones you've looked at so far, any themes pop out?
Yeah, well, I saw some distinct themes, and some of them like a celebration of the season and all that kind of talk of the heat and the sensuality of that. And then there were a lot of love poems and lots of passion, lots of summer romance, and sometimes summer romance gone wrong, which was very exciting. And of course, near and dear to my heart, because that's all my summer romances have
Always go wrong? Yes.
Always went wrong. I've never had one go right. But, and then there was some poems that were kind of tragic. So even though, you know, summer is this time where we think of fun in the sun or doing really lazy stuff, you know, a lot of them were like, summer actually sucks because all this bad stuff happened. And I like those poems.
And are there mistakes that teenage poets tend to make in you want to warn them against?
Oh, not at all. In fact, I'm so excited reading the submissions because I think that teenagers do everything right in terms of poetry. I think that they take risks and take liberties and use language in new and inventive ways. I think because they're right on the edge of where language is starting to change, you know, where some of our new language is coming into the way that we're going to eventually speak in 10 years.
Lots of texty acronyms and things?
Yeah, no. Texty acronyms. Yeah, and just using words in interesting ways. So I say just keep doing it to people submitting.
So what about your process as a poet? Do you revise and revise and revise, or just after that eureka moment are you done and say print?
Print and straight to the publisher. No. Yeah, no, it's very obsessively I revise, especially for sound. More than content or more than, you know, what I'm trying to say. I think less about that and more just how the poem sounds.
And does that entail reading it aloud again and again?
Reading it aloud again and again and kind of obsessively thinking about small words that maybe, you know, we take for granted or not even thinking about.
Well, I guess the next time I'll see you is after you've read all these hundreds of poems and decided which you think is the best.
Exactly, yeah. I can't wait for that moment.
Dorothy Alasky, thank you.
Thank you so much.
High school poets, this is your last chance to enter the Studio 360 Summer Poetry Challenge. The deadline is Monday, August 18th at midnight. No extensions. All the details are at studio360.org. Coming up, I'll talk with book designer Peter Mendelsohn. When he created the visual identity for Stieg Larsson's mega best-selling Girl with the Dragon Tattoo books, he knew he had to break the thriller mold.
There's like a shadowy guy with a trench coat, or there's like a dagger with blood on it, or there's definitely blood on it.
That's later in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And by TiVo. No need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or interfaces to access cable TV and streaming from Netflix and Hulu Plus. Learn more at TiVo.com.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and this is Studio 360.
8 more miles from Louisville, the hometown of my heart.
Thanks for joining us today, especially you new listeners in Louisville, Kentucky, on WFPL. We're glad to have you tuning in.
8 more miles from Louisville, the hometown of my heart.
About once a decade, an American graphic designer gets kind of famous, often for designing book covers. Right now, the guy to watch is Peter Mendelsohn, one of the small handful of big-deal book cover designers working today. He's done the covers for new editions of Dostoevsky and James Joyce, for Sonia Sotomayor's memoir, and most famously, for Stieg Larsson. And now for Peter Mendelsohn, because this summer he's published two books of his own. One, called Cover, is a collection of some of his best designs over the years. The other, though, is very different. A smart and wide-ranging illustrated essay about the experience of reading. It's called What We See When We Read. And he is here with me right now, Peter Mendelsohn. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you for having me.
So as I said, your big commercial breakthrough design was for the cover of Stieg Larsson's The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. When that first one came out, it didn't really look like a book of that mystery thriller genre at all. Can you describe it?
The final jacket for The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo was yellow, which is a bright yellow, which is already stepping outside of the norms for the genre.
Which is dark and blue and red
that's
and
right.
brown.
And there's like a shadowy guy with a trench coat, or there's like a dagger with blood on it, or there's definitely blood on it. That's the big, like the signifier ne plus ultra for that genre is blood. You could put a puppy on a cover and splatter it with blood and you have a crime novel. However, this jacket was bright yellow, so already we're way outside of the comfort zone. There is no murder weapon. There is no damsel in distress. There's nothing brooding or sinister about it. The typography's broken up in a pretty kind of jigsaw way. There is a very stylized Asian dragon that sort of weaves in and out of the typography. I would say that its only merit is that it's reasonably pretty. You know, that is the thing that a jacket should be.
And millions of copies later, if you were going to be judging that and those covers now, what do you think?
I think they did the trick. I'm not that embarrassed of them. I think I would have been embarrassed if there had been all of that blood and a gun or something, or at least I wouldn't have been proud of being involved in the endeavor. And I do feel, in a way, that we published the hell out of those books.
And now and for the rest of your life, you will be known as the guy who did those.
Right.
How's that?
Well, you know, Kurt, I mean, part of this idea of publishing two books of my own is to try to
change the subject.
Yeah, that's right.
So do you have, as when you look at cover designs, pet peeves, like, you know, all these books that have come out in the last few years with women from the neck down, or one that I have noticed for many years, which is any novel set in Africa has to have these like fake little carved wood letter forms. I mean, are there things that bug you as cliches or formula?
Yeah, well, you said it. Anything that's a cliche, anything that has been done in the past, and thus we think, well, this book sold pretty well and it had the girl shot from the back on the cover. So
we'll do more of that.
Yeah, exactly. Hence, that is the thing that made that book do well. So let's do it again. However, it turns out to be quite the opposite. I think the best bet that any book jacket has of getting your attention is by being different from everything else around it. I mean, that is really how something grabs your attention.
Well, and one of the uncliched, of the many uncliched things that I saw in this book cover is your covers for the Kafka novels, which have these big bright colors.
Right.
That doesn't seem very Kafka-esque.
Well, see, that's right. And I mean, part of the fun of that experience of doing that Kafka project was not just getting people to look at the covers for Kafka differently, but hopefully encouraging people to read him slightly differently. I mean, there are these wonderful stories of Kafka reading Metamorphosis for Friends and just laughing riotously. I mean, they're funny books in their own way. And my hope is that if you make sort of funny and playful and exuberant Kafka covers, that people will bring that attitude towards a reading of the books.
Looking at your work in this monograph, a lot of your covers remind me of books that are were in my parents' library from the 50s and 60s and 70s. Not in some in-your-face Mad Men retro way, but in their simplicity and in their abstraction and being less decorative and understated. Is that just because that's who you are, or did you go back and look a lot of 1962 books?
No, actually, I didn't go back, but I have very specific memories of the books on my parents' shelves, and they've always sort of stayed with me. And I would say that that's the generation I feel most sort of simpatico with. And there was this wonderful period in the 40s and 50s and early 60s where book design for literary fiction was primarily abstract. And some of the most beautiful jackets came out of that period. And those, I mean, at least they're some of my favorites.
Are there any genres or authors that you just would say, nah, I'm not interested?
I don't think I've ever refused to work on a book jacket before. I think probably if I would, it would be on political grounds, but I've never run up against that before.
But my anti-gun control book, you won't design?
Exactly. That is the one, actually.
So in this new book, this book of new material that you've written called What We See When We Read, you write very interestingly to me about how we each think we know how fictional characters look, We think, oh, Anna Karenina, I know what she looks like. But when somebody is actually quizzed about, well, so what does that character look like? They're very fuzzy and approximate. Why is that, and why are we sure until we're quizzed, which doesn't happen often, that we know what somebody looks like?
Despite the fact that I do this every day, I try to draw these sort of visual elements out of books in order to put them on book jackets. It never really occurred to me until this year that it was kind of a strange process. And we have this sort of myth that that process, the process of reading, being a reader, is sort of like sitting in a room and watching a movie. And the more I looked into what the process really felt like, as opposed to these myths of what reading is supposed to be like, the more I found that there was this very wide discrepancy between how we talk about reading and what reading actually is.
You are, I'm guessing, in your mid-40s.
Yes, sir.
You've only been a professional designer for the last dozen years or so. You had this whole other career as a classical pianist. What was wrong with that job, and why at 30 whatever did you decide, I'm gonna start over?
I get career makes it sound much more glamorous than it was, and maybe that was the problem.
You were being paid to perform on the piano.
Right, very little, which is really the crux of the problem I had just had. I have two girls. The first of them had just been born, and we needed health insurance. And
had you always thought, well, if I weren't playing the piano professionally, I could be a designer, or was this a new thought?
This was brand new. I mean, really, the transition from piano to design took maybe around a year or so. After my wife and I were married, I had designed our wedding invitation. I designed some other kind of little things. It just seemed as good a shot as any for a new career. I mean, really, honestly, I might have ended up in anything.
Okay, you have no formal training. Your mother suggested to a friend that he talk to his friend who's the famous designer Chip Kidd, and hey, talk to my son.
Right.
That's how it happened?
Yeah, that's how it happened. My mom's friend is the Scrabble partner of Chip Kidd's boyfriend. So through that game of telephone, somehow I got an interview with Chip at Knopf.
And he said, you're a kid, you're a natural, you're hired, basically?
Kind of. It was a little less dramatic than that. After I met with him and showed him my work, he seemed happy with what I had done. And then I think it was maybe 2 days later, I got a call from him and said, you know what? Someone just left. Why don't you come back in? And I met everybody else, and I was working there a week later. And it's the only job I've ever had other than playing the piano.
Now, you design books. You've gotten to this place as a acclaimed book designer. You could keep doing this presumably forever. Do you have a wish to sort of try other things? And, if I can design that, I could design this, or I could design that.
Coming to a profession late, the way I did to design, makes you keenly aware of the fact that, hopefully life is long and full of surprises and the road forks many times. And I feel like the big lesson for me about moving from the piano to design is that there are other things out there.
Well, and that big risky decision worked out.
Yeah, it worked great. That doesn't ensure that the next one will.
Well, I look forward to whatever it is you choose to keep designing, including if it's simply books.
Thank you so much.
Peter Mendelsohn's books, Cover and What We See When We Read, are out right now. Here at Studio 360, we love hearing about cultural works that changed your life, maybe pushed you to take your career in a different direction. For years, when she was young, Abigail Washburn was single-minded about meeting her goals. She wanted to go to college and then law school and become a lawyer. She even knew where she wanted to practice.
The focus of my studies throughout college, then those years after college, was to prepare to go study law in Beijing. When I graduated from college, the Colorado College, in 1999, I moved to Vermont, and I became a lobbyist. So in between these state legislature sessions, I would be either in Beijing acting as a intern at a consulting firm or going to school at the Middlebury College for Chinese.
But one night in Vermont, she went to a party at a friend's house.
I think it might have been Beau, my boyfriend at the time, put on a record. I heard it out of the corner of my ear. And it was this beautiful, old-sounding voice. and this incredibly rhythmic, vibrant, but rich and deep sounding instrument. And it ended up that it was Doc Watson playing Shady Grove, and he was playing the banjo and singing.
Shady Grove, my little love, Shady Grove, I say. Shady Grove, my little love, I'm bound to go away. Cheeks as red as a blooming rose and eyes are the prettiest brown. She's the darling of my heart, sweetest little girl.
And I heard this voice and I was drawn to it. I sat next to the record player. I played it over and over and over again. And I remember thinking, it sounds ancient, and yet he's sitting right here in this room with me. I was struck by it as something that sounded uniquely American. And I had this revelation. It truly was a revelation where I thought to myself, now I just don't know enough about America. I love this place, China. I'm obsessed, even obsessed with this place, China, but I don't know enough about my own country's roots and culture.
Shady Grove, I say. Shady Grove, my little love, I'm bound to go away.
I went out and I bought a banjo after that, and I sat there, and the first tune I learned was Shady Grove. I started learning about old-time music, and I literally thought it was just going to be that. It would be something I'd take along with me to China to remind me of home. So once I had taken the exams and I realized I was going to Beijing University for a master's in law, I decided that I wanted to go on a big road trip in America because I figured I'd be spending the rest of my life in some kind of cubicle and a working situation. So that's what I did. I stopped at the Augusta Heritage Center in West Virginia. They had incredible old fiddlers and people immersed in the tradition in West Virginia there teaching music. So I learned some banjo tunes and some songs there. And then I went to the IBMA, which is this International Bluegrass Music Association convention out of Louisville, Kentucky. There weren't many young women there, so I ran into a bunch of these young women in the hallway one night, and we saw each other and we said, We've gotta hang out. So we were like, okay, fifth floor, 11 PM. And this was the last stop on my Farewell to the States tour. And a guy from a record label walked by and said, you guys should come down the hall and play for the president. And what do you know? The next week I was in Nashville cutting demos for a record label. And I called my friends in Beijing and I said, hey guys, I'm not coming back. And they said, why? What's up? And I said, well, I got offered a record deal. And they said, you play music?
I got a mother.
For some reason, Doc Watson's voice and the banjo led me to discover my own voice as a human, as an artist. It's like his sound took hold in my heart, and I carried it with me, and I could feel his voice coming through me, and I had a reason to sing suddenly. I'm really glad I'm not a lawyer living in Beijing, working at a cubicle every day.
Mama's at ease in social life. Papa remembers the names with the faces. I can speak on the topic of religion. Just can't seem to make a clear decision. I gotta run, 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 run. Run to the city of refuge. I gotta run, I gotta run.
That's the musician Abigail Washburn. She was talking about Doc Watson, who died 2 years ago at age 89. Right now, Washburn is in the middle of recording an all-banjo album of songs about China with her husband, Bella Fleck. Michael Rayfield produced our story. Has a record or book or movie or building or some other work of art changed your life? Tell us about it at studio360.org. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
No matter how strong, I'm gonna take you down with one little stone.
When Rufus Wainwright started making records in the late 90s, he was unlike anyone else out there. His songs were as much turn of the 20th century as they were turn of the 21st, sung in his vibrato-y tenor, full of drama and brutally, personally honest.
Dinner at 8 was okay before the toast full of blues. It was great until those old magazines got us started up again.
And he was one of the first gay pop stars to sing completely openly about his sexuality. Wainwright has been drenched in music his entire life. He's the son of the folk singers Kate McGarrigle and Loudon Wainwright. Now 40, he has made 7, count them, 7 solo albums, set Shakespeare's sonnets to music, written an opera, and he has just released a best-of collection called Vibrate, the best of Rufus Wainwright. Sir?
Yes.
Welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks for having me.
As we've said, you come from this impressive musical dynasty, your
yes.
father, your mother, your sister,
yes.
your aunts, your cousins.
Yes.
Leonard Cohen is
yes.
the grandfather of your daughter.
Yes, yes.
You're like, I don't know, what are you like? You're like the Cashes and Carters or the Kennedys or the Bushes or something.
Well, I mean, yes, to a degree. We don't have the cash of the Bushes.
Yeah.
We probably have the cash of the Kennedys, considering there's so many of
yeah.
them.
yeah.
But
has that been – I mean, one can imagine all the good things
yeah.
about that. But is it like a equally balanced good and bad side of that thing?
Well, it's just the way it is. You know, my parents were very – well, especially my mother was certainly dynastic when she met my dad. I mean, she
really
she,
thought of it in that.
Oh
way.
Yeah, no. She her thing was when she met my dad. She was like, "That's going to be the father of my kids." I mean, she was really drawn
so
to him.
So it really was like June Carter and Johnny
on
Cash.
On a visceral, yeah. She saw him on stage,
yeah.
and then he saw her perform, and it was
huh.
there was this real mutual fascination with their artistry and their talent, and then sadly that. Kind of fascination became intense jealousy, and it was a kind of a fascinating folk breakup. But anyways, I don't know. I was born into that, and along with, you know, songs written about either their relationship or myself or my sister. I mean, it was all laid out.
And
then we had other friends who were similar.
Right.
You know, with like Richard and Linda Thompson, and
that didn't work out either.
And the Seegers and
yeah.
stuff. So it's not common, but it's also not unusual.
May we hear a song?
Sure.
Going to a Town.
Okay, here we go.
Alrighty.
You've done is good. I really need to know.
That was Rufus Wainwright performing Going to a Town. One of the sources of the power of that song, it seems to me, is instead of being some whiny, scratchy, folk singery sounding person singing such a song, you have this beautiful, classically gorgeous voice singing. The combination of that with this holy cow kind of negativism is it gives it real power.
Yeah, well, it's a nice – I mean, it is – that song especially is a nice – sort of hybrid of both, you know, the classic protest song and an operatic aria, you know. I try to kind of meld them into one.
As we've said, as you just mentioned, you come from both this folk pop background and have been influenced by opera, one of your big passions since you were a kid. Has opera influenced your music?
Oh, very much so. No, I mean, when I was about 13 years old, I first became obsessed with opera. It was after listening to a recording of Verdi's Requiem. And it was an instantaneous, transformative experience where I transfixified. and that's all I could listen to for a good, you know, 10 years, really. So
your adolescence was spent in opera.
It was totally operatic.
You've written one opera, Prima Donna. You're working on another.
Yes.
And this next one you're doing is about the Roman Emperor Hadrian.
Yes, it is Hadrian and Antoninus.
It's one of the good emperors.
Yes, one of the good emperors.
And one of the gay emperors.
Well, one of the really gay emperors. I mean, I think every emperor probably had their dalliances with.
That was part of loving Greece.
But I think what's interesting about the story of Hadrian is that he was actually in love with Antoninus, who was another man. And he was persecuted for it. I mean, it was – and a lot of the same kind of problems that exist today with homophobia and so forth were very much present back then.
That sounds like a great timely, dare I say it, commercial idea.
Yeah, it is. An empire and, you know, Hadrian's Wall. And Hadrian invented he created Palestine.
Uh-huh.
A lot of those borders that he initially drew, we still fight over today. So it's kind of a fascinating story in that sense.
In the past, you've talked about how your parents could both deal with personal issues on stage through their music, but not so much in real life. Is that something that you share with them, that it's easier for you to sing emotional lyrics in public than say privately to a person, this is what I'm feeling about you?
There's people in my life with whom that's the case. Not all, but there are. One thing that I will say, though, is, and this is something that occurred to me several years ago during my Saturn return, meaning when I was around 27, and I was a little, you know, foggy and mixed up
and druggy
and weird, is that, you know, I did realize that artistry and poetry will not save your life if your life needs to be saved. I mean, there's a point when you have to kind of get off the trolley ride and, you know, go see a therapist and, you know, take care of yourself. And it has nothing to do with art. And I think that can actually be a bit of a trap early on for a lot of musicians and so forth.
Well, and the other part of that is thinking that your misery in life is nothing but good for your art.
Yeah, no, I know. I would say that misery does help at time with songwriting, but you have to be – you have to be have the energy to write the songs, you know. So, but as I found out, you know, life was no matter what state you're in or what's going on, you will always be served your fair share of misery, yes. No matter what.
And now that you've been a father for a few years, yeah. Has it changed your regard for your father?
Yes, it has. I mean, what's interesting is that, you know, my dad. The other day, I went for a walk with him around the reservoir. Up in Central Park, and at the end of the walk, my daughter's three now, and she's at that age where, you know, you're going to get a kiss sometimes, and sometimes you're not going to get a kiss, and you're going to, but then when she does shine her light on you and says, "Daddy, I love you," there's a nuclear reaction, you know, that occurs. So, but anyways, I was walking around with my dad, and I, you know, got to the end of the walk, and I hugged him, and I said, "Dad, I just want to tell you that I love you, because now I know how great that makes you feel when your kid says that." And so I felt it necessary to kind of impart that to him, because I'm now, you know, begging for it.
Yes, exactly. you've said many times, talking about your coming out, which you did very, very young, realizing you were gay, that your parents were not so cool with this.
Yeah.
And here, which is so strange to me, these bohemian countercultural types. And it's the late 80s,
it's called,
the 90s.
It's called the Cher syndrome.
Speaking of Cher and her trans daughter, son.
Yeah, I mean, she was famously somewhat...
Yeah.
Difficult.
But you're, but
and one would think that Cher would, you know.
You would think, but she's Cher. Your parents are these hippies.
Well, Cher was somewhat hippie-ish.
She was back
say.
In the day.
Come on.
Yes, right. Were you surprised?
You know, it's so hard for me because there's this one wild card, which is that all of this took place in 1987. And at that point, you know, AIDS was just everywhere, and to be gay was essentially a death sentence.
And you, and so as a parent, you think, my kid is gonna.
Yeah, and I was very, very young too. I was 14. So, so I don't think it's fair to really judge. That being said, for anyone who's out there whose parents are not equipped, let's say, to deal with it, I'm an example of someone who, you know, made it through.
And it's not just conventionally, stereotypically bigoted people who can't deal with it.
Yeah, yeah, no, I think it's once it's your own kid, it's a whole other story.
Can you imagine your own daughter declaring herself X, Y, or Z, something that would freak you out?
Probably. I don't know. I want to say an attorney, but I quite like my attorney, so I don't want to be mean.
your mother raised you. You were extremely close to her. Is there like a most important lesson about either being an artist or a human being that she taught you?
Well, the thing that was most important that my mother taught me is to always make sure to lay down the arms, you know, whenever you after a battle. Probably because for her, she wasn't able to let go of some anger herself.
Huh.
She really felt it necessary to imbue it into her children, that quality. And I think that meant a lot to her.
And was that not letting go of anger and bitterness professionally as well as personally in her case?
Well, yeah, both. I mean, both. I mean, she was very, very kind of haunted almost by her talent. And because she didn't make it and because she had to kind of retreat to Canada with her kids, I mean, there was a lot of disappointment there.
Yeah. But we've all heard of her, so she didn't make it.
No, I know. But she wasn't, you know, Bonnie Raitt or,
you know,
who she knew and loved, or Carole King or whatever. I mean, there was... She wasn't quite
that. Or the Canadians.
Fellow
Canadians.
Or Joni Mitchell for that reason. But in a strange way, I feel that also gave their music this other quality, which There's a certain darkness there, a certain depth, a kind of perspective of the outsider that she put in her work, which makes it so, I don't know, timeless. We all feel basically abandoned. It's great.
And there are a lot of incredibly successful superstars who then have to force the idea of soul.
I mean, I think the whole thing was, I mean, I love Carly Simon, and we knew her quite a bit growing up. We would see her occasionally when we go down to Martha's Vineyard. But there was this thing of like, you know, my mom would be writing about, you know, mashed potatoes and bringing up a teenage daughter and kind of like being alone in the dark in her room, turning on and off light switches. And meanwhile, Carly would be like, do I look great in this dress? And I'm making love tonight to some guy on the wharf. You know, and my mom was always like, oh, God. I mean, she was always great, but there was something. But she wouldn't go, she couldn't write this kind of fluffy, which, I mean, I admire about Carly. Here, I hope Carly doesn't hear this. But she was never able to sort of just play that game of I'm going to write a sexy love song that people are going to want to hear on the radio.
Yeah.
There's got to be some kind of Bronte angle.
Yes. Before you go, will you play another of your songs?
Sure.
And this is The Art Teacher?
Yes.
Great.
Tell him it was him. Oh, I wish I could tell him. Oh, I wish I could have told him. I looked at the Rubens and Rembrandts.
That's Rufus Wainwright playing the art teacher. That was great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Rufus Wainwright's new album is called Vibrate, the best of Rufus Wainwright. That's it for this hour of Studio 360. Thank you very much for listening. You can keep up with us every day on Twitter. It's at Studio 360 Show. And high school writers, time is running out to send in your poetry about summer. The deadline's this Monday, August 18th at midnight. Studio 360's a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Ital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Shruti Pinnamaneni,
Ariel Roland Waring,
Marshall Bright,
Hannah Alonji.
And thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, poetry's new It Girl didn't start with the classics.
We didn't actually have a whole lot of literature in our house. That might seem to be counterintuitive, but we had a lot of theology, and then we had a lot of Tom Clancy.
Poet Patricia Lockwood, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.